Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today, my guest is Live Mestrandetet. I'm trying hard on the name, but he's Associate Professor of Latin America and Area Studies at the University of Oslo. He studies, in particular, presidentialism and constitutionalism in Latin America. So, Live, thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Greg. This is very nice.
Okay, so what I always start with is to ask people, what first got you interested in studying Latin American politics?
Well, for me, it started in 1993-1994 when I was an exchange student at high school in the Dominican Republic. And this was a particularly important political year in that country. And there were some important elections, presidential elections in 1994 with Joaquin Balaguer running for his eighth re-election or something in Dominican Republic for the Reformist Party. And I lived in a very political party, political family that belonged to the opposition party, PRD, which ran with Peña Gómez as candidate. So that got me interested in Latin American politics.
Okay, and how much interest is there in Latin America in your corner of the world? Is there more than we might expect?
Yeah, I think so. There is more than you might expect, but of course, Latin America struggles with the attention with other areas of the South, like Africa, where Norway is much more involved. But there are many people studying Spanish in Norway, and there are many youth interested in Latin America, and many people are traveling, and more people are traveling to the region. So there is some interest, definitely.
Okay. Well, then, just one more question then. How did you choose the Dominican Republic?
Well, that was just by coincidence. I actually tried to get to Australia to do an exchange there, and they didn't accept me there. And then it was Dominican Republic. So just by accident, actually.
Okay. So since you study presidentialism, I just want to ask you just a broad question. Given all of the problems that we've been seeing in with Latin American presidents, do you think Latin American presidentialism is in crisis?
Well, it depends on how you define crisis. In terms of presidentialism dying out or being removed in Latin America, I don't think it is in crisis. But in terms of presidentialism providing government stability, which it's supposed to do by the fixed term, yes, I think it's in crisis. Of course, many of the issues that create these crises come from other factors than institutions, be that general violence in some parts of Latin America, be that economic crisis that are going on in other parts of Latin America. But yes, you might say that there are some signs of crisis. Now, these days, we're reading about crisis in Paraguay surrounding re-election, which is an issue that is repeated in many countries. So to some extent, yes, it is in crisis.
Okay, I guess another question could be then, has it ever not been in crisis, I suppose?
Yeah, that's another question. So I've been involved with the presidentialism versus parliamentarism debate for several years, and yes, has it? I think it's always been to some extent in crisis, but what I've been studying for the last couple of years is how presidentialism is surprisingly able to use the institutions and the constitution that exist to resolve these crises in a manner that does not end in violence like it did before. So to some degree, if you look at it historically, we see that the crises that are recurring events in Latin America do not end up with military coups, at least not as often as they used to be. To some extent, presidentialism, I think, is resolving these recurring crises in a better fashion than it used to do. But in a region such as Latin America, there will always be, at least the way it is now, always be some sort of crisis going on, and the institutions are challenged constantly almost.
So, yeah, and we're talking about presidentialism as if it's a living thing, but of course what we have are political actors. Would you say we have political actors who are choosing to find ways to resolve institutional crisis without resorting to violence? Is this a conscious effort?
Yeah, I think it's a conscious effort. In the same manner, it's a conscious effort to use these institutions to gain political advantage, like we've seen, for instance, recently in Brazil. So in Brazil, you'll see that the crisis surrounding the presidency of Dilma was resolved to some extent, right? But it was also political actors also used the institutions and the constitutional text in a manner that benefited them politically. So it's not only the issue that they're trying to avoid violence, they're also trying to find loopholes in constitutions and use the institutions to their own advantage, of course.
Right. Thinking, you mentioned the presidentialism versus parliamentarism debate, which was at its peak, or it got going really in the 1980s, with Juan Linz and others. What do you think of that debate? Is that still a useful debate?
Well, I use it as a point of reference when I discuss presidentialism. But many of the critics of that debate have a very good point, is that presidentialism is not likely to be replaced with a parliamentary system in Latin America. So in that regard, it's a debate that is relatively irrelevant. And more interesting is to see how the institutions of presidentialism actually work and how they could be improved in a sense. So it's extremely unlikely, as it was in the 80s and 90s, and even more unlikely today, that the countries of Latin America will go from presidentialism to parliamentarism. And in that manner, I guess it is irrelevant.
Do you see do you agree with that debate often was talking about the superiority of parliamentarism? Do you think is that a view you share? And do you think that presidentialism has become more flexible because it becomes more parliamentary?
Yeah, well, coming from a parliamentary country in Scandinavia, it's hard not to think that parliamentarism is a system that works better than presidentialism. But when I started studying this debate, my take on this was that when we look at all these presidential falls that we've had in Latin America since the mid-80s, my argument was that this contradicts the theories of Juan Linz, because it demonstrated that the institutions were able to find solutions to ongoing political crises by replacing presidents or by calling for new elections, for instance. And in that matter, my argument was that presidentialism is much more flexible than the critics open up for.
Right.
So, because we did see that the use of, you might say, creative readings of constitutions in order to solve crises, and all of these involve to some sort issue or institutional flexibility. So I think that, yes, Latin American presidentialism is more flexible than the original critics argued, at least.
Yeah, and certainly for me, you coming from a Scandinavian country with a parliamentary system, and me coming from the U.S. with a presidential system, it's very hard to talk about presidentialism being superior in any way. which is something when I'm teaching Latin American politics now, and I just try to explain to students, this is how these different systems work. And it's fascinating to see that for them, it's alien to think outside the box of presidentialism.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that I've, over the past several years, been sort of thinking about when we had problems, of course, in Brazil, but also in Paraguay, is that presidential impeachment seems to be like a parliamentary no confidence vote these days. Do you agree with that, or do you have a different view?
No, I agree with that. I think in two ways we can look at impeachments or removal of presidents, or in general, as some sort of vote of no confidence. Earlier, we had the example of Ecuador, where they creatively declared the president for being incapaz, or being loco with Bucaram.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one way of going around not needing an impeachment vote. So that was clearly a way of removing president that looked quite parliamentary, because the Congress argued that you only need 50% of of the votes, or a regular majority in order to remove the president. But what we've seen lately is that the impeachment itself is being used for pure political reasons. And you mentioned Paraguay and also Brazil. So this is a new development, I think. And of course, when you remove President Lula in Brazil, for instance, in Paraguay, for instance, for poor performance of duties, you know, that motive and that argument, that legal argument, sounds pretty much like a vote of no confidence. And the same issue you had with Dilma, of course. And in both of these cases, none of the presidents were personally implicated in a scandal, like a corruption scandal, as, for instance, the recent impeachment of Perez Molina in Guatemala, which we would think is a more classical form of impeachment.
Right.
So in my view, yes, these are looking more like no confidence votes, with, of course, the caveat that in most presidential systems, it requires 2/3 of the votes in at least one of the chambers in order to remove the president.
Right. And in the case of Brazil, it seemed totally clear that while there were scandals around, the impeachment was based on policy, not on crime. But that didn't seem to bother anybody.
No, it didn't. And of course, they found the old law of 1950 that was quite vague in its clauses and all the reasons you may have for removing a president. So when you read that law, and of course read also other constitutions, you see that you can actually remove a president constitutionally by just referring to poor performance of duties,
yeah,
which is a very vague term. And of course, if you can assemble a great enough majority, that can be used then to actually remove the president in order to provoke or to create changes in policy, which obviously a grand majority of Brazilian Congress felt was necessary to some extent.
Right. So in general terms, at what point can presidential institutions no longer solve a crisis? And so I'm thinking of Honduras as an example, but there are others. When does it just not work anymore?
Well, in Honduras, you had the, there was a crisis than what one could see coming, of course, and it ended as it did in a military coup. One of the reasons Honduras ended like that is, of course, that there was no escape valve according to the constitutions. There was no way of impeaching the president. But I think you see with cases like Honduras and maybe also a case like Venezuela today that when you have really fragile democracies, these institutions tend not to work. They tend not to be respected by key actors. So in Honduras, of course, the Supreme Court would send in the military, or that was at least the story, and remove the president. So when key actors like the military actors or the court system or Congress no longer respects the playing rules, of course, then these texts and these rules that regulate impeachment and so on, they are no longer functioning, of course, and then they can't be used to solve any crisis. And you see in Honduras, it ended with the military taking Zelaya on a plane and sending him in his pajamas to Costa Rica. And I guess you have the same thing to a much greater extent going on in Venezuela, where I think it's unlikely that the institution or the constitution could work as a solution to that crisis.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask you about Venezuela, but one thing, when you're talking about Honduras, I thought there was an interesting point that I hadn't considered, and that was, could it be that Honduras, the problem in Honduras was that its presidentialism was built in a way that was too inflexible, so there was no way to discuss term limits, there was no way to deal with impeachment, and so the institutions themselves had no built-in flexibility.
Yeah, that's at least an argument that I think is interesting to discuss, because there were two issues there. You mentioned both the re-election clause, which was seen as unconstitutional even to mention or discuss publicly in Honduras, and the other issue is the lack of an impeachment clause, which was removed a couple of years prior to the coup in 2009. So I know that Congress, the Friday before the coup, which occurred on a Sunday, was discussing whether they could hold a vote in order to remove Zelaya by institutional means. And they were discouraged to do so, and they didn't. And it ended up in a coup 2 days later. So I think that there is a lesson that if you have institutions that are too rigid and there is no escape valve in the Constitution, then the crisis lingers on with no solution, and it opens a venue, at least it opens an opportunity for actors to seek out the military as an umpire to decide here. And that, of course, was what occurred in Honduras when the opposition and the Supreme Court managed to convince the military to take their side and have them remove Zelaya.
Yeah, and what's curious is that later, then, Honduras changed the rules so that you could run for re-election. Do you know, have they changed the rules on impeachment, or is it still not possible in Honduras?
Oh, that's a good question. One of the recommendations that came out, they had, of course, a committee to analyze the whole crisis in 2009. And one of the recommendations that came out was that they should create more flexible clauses for re-election. And that, of course, was changed. But I don't know whether or not the impeachment clause has changed. I need to check up on that.
Yeah. Now, thinking about Venezuela, which, of course, is the big case now, and it seemed like you were suggesting the answer would be no, but can existing political institutions solve the Venezuelan political crisis?
No, I don't think so. Had the existing political institutions worked in some way, I think Maduro would have been out already. I think the lessons since the parliamentary election in December 2015 are quite clear that the existing institution cannot fix this crisis. We have a stacked Supreme Court, which is a de facto political actor. Parliament is being paralyzed by the Supreme Court, of course. The opposition was denied its two-thirds majority. The recall referendum was stopped. Regional election has been postponed. So all evidence are that the current regime is not willing to cede power through regular institutional means. Had they been so, then I guess Ramos Ayub, the former Congress president, would have been right in saying that we shall remove Maduro within 3 months, because he thought that with two-thirds majority following the rules of the game, they would be able to remove the president. And this was not so. So my guess is that something else must happen in order to create a change in Venezuela. I don't think if the regime is not willing to be removed in 2016 and 2017, I doubt that they will organize free and fair election for 2018 and will be willing to cede power that year. So I'm afraid that there must. There's a higher likelihood that change will occur through a military coup, or that the protests that are going on, the mobilization is successful to some degree, or both of these factors in conjunction. I think this is more likely than that suddenly the political institutions of Venezuela will start working.
Yeah, well, and I suppose you could argue that this is not a crisis of presidentialism at all, because the institutions were trying to function. There was a parliamentary elections held. The opposition gained a majority because the government was unpopular, and that's what's supposed to happen. But then if the government refuses to play by the rules, that's not a problem of presidentialism. That's a problem of authoritarianism.
Yeah, well, Venezuela is now an authoritarian regime. I think most observers will acknowledge that fact today. And of course, it was the regime was put on the test when the opposition gained two-thirds majority in parliament. And the regime basically failed that test tremendously. And now, of course, with the latest things have been going on with the latest Supreme Court sentence that paralyzes fully the parliament and the inhabilitation of Capriles, for instance, we see that we are now dealing with an authoritarian regime. So to hold this as to hold the Venezuelan cases and arguments against presidentialism, I don't see that. I think there are too many other factors involved here that could explain this downfall from some type of participatory democracy or what have you towards authoritarianism that we see today.
Right. Okay, we are now out of time. I've been talking to live Marstandretit, who is Associate Professor of Latin American and Area Studies at the University of Oslo. Live, thank you again so much for taking some time.
And thank you for inviting me, Greg.